instance, an experience everyone has had it, which was almost incommunicable, precisely because it disappeared as soon as you noticed it. Virginia Woolf had gotten it down over and over. The experience was not an act or anything that might form an anecdote or a history, but an instant of perception, a moment that clarified relations and qualities long standing in place. You are sitting or standing somewhere, and the scene composes around your attempt to take it in. You sense a kind of buzz, not an actual sound, but an increased presentiment of meaning. It may happen indoors at the dinner table with friends or family, the fruit and cakes reduced to scraps, the napkins tossed onto the table as the conversation breaks into small exchanges, or late at night when the house is quiet and the cats stand next to each other on the living room carpet, alert, posed, like matched china statues. Or when one of the children, unable to sleep, lies down on the sofa amid books, toys, and stuffed animals, and with mouth open and dribbling slightly, at last drops off. But usually it happens in the open air, as you are walking across a field, or that part of the beach where the surf washes up, and the sand grows darker and then lighter as the ocean passes over it and then drains away. This is what life is supposed to be. You are overcome by a sense of sufficiency. The feeling may be derived from memories of contentment as a child, an early experience not just of sufficiency, but of suffusion, in which each element, air, trees, animals, people, has its own character, but no more. Each relation, its own necessity, but no more. The sensation is impersonal and non-egotistical, akin to a religious swelling out into the universe. Not, I am large enough to take all this in, but all this immensity is happening before me. And then you may ridicule what you're feeling as a delusion or mere self-approval, and particularly if you are a man, you say, this is nice, but so what? And you forget it. As I read a writer, I was sure I'd always hated. I suddenly found my way to these presentiments and to other sensations and events normally lodged below the sill of consciousness. And as these things came back, I began to read Woolf with greater and greater pleasure, rather like a starfish gaining strength as it eats its way across the bottom of the ocean. Reading Woolf made me read Woolf better. But I also read myself better, and there was something else, something about her method and style that now seemed powerful and satisfying in a way that went very deep, though I couldn't at first put my finger on it. My earlier misreading was more than a personal failure. It was also, I now knew, a cultural failure. But an amazing change had taken place. Woolf's writing, beautiful, original, noble, but often considered minor, affected, insufferable, now seemed inevitably great, and, among other things, a glorious finish to such survey courses in Western classics as literature humanities. The entire tradition of Western literature could be heard breathing through that book. And there was that other baffling quality, something in Woolf's work that suggested the nature of reading and remembering itself. To the Lighthouse, first published in 1927, is in fact a hard book to like as a teenager. The characters blur into one another, I heard a student say in Marina Van Zylen's class. I wasn't sure who I was reading about. The book was elusive at first reading, seemingly plotless, seemingly all spirit and no muscle, and almost suffocating in its insistent delicacy. How inconsequential the story seems at first. A few years before the First World War, at the end of summer, a well-known philosophy professor and his wife, Mr. and Mrs. Ramsey, and their 8 children and their friends and servants are staying together in the Ramsey's summer house, shabby but large and comfortable, on the Isle of Skye. Mrs. Ramsey, after reading to James, her youngest, sits knitting at a window in the late afternoon, looking out at the lighthouse across the bay as her husband, preoccupied, and reciting Tennyson's Charge of the Light Brigade to himself, often aloud, walks up and down on the lawn. Mrs. Ramsay has mysterious thoughts of shrinking into herself and of peace and possibly of death. The hour has not passed without difficulty. Earlier, James, who was 6, had asked to go to the lighthouse, which was well out in the bay, a considerable journey by open boat across a rough northern sea. Mrs. Ramsay had said they would go the next day, if the weather was fine. But, said his father, stopping in front of the drawing-room window, it won't be fine. Had there been an axe handy or a poker, any weapon that would have gashed a hole in his father's breast and killed him, there and then, James would have seized it. Such were the extremes of emotion that Mr. Ramsay excited in his children's breasts by his mere presence. Standing as now, lean as a knife, narrow as the blade of one, grinning sarcastically, not only with the pleasure of disillusioning his son and casting ridicule upon his wife, who was 10,000 times better in every way than he was, James thought, but also with some secret conceit at his own accuracy of judgment. What he said was true. It was always true. He was incapable of untruth, never tampered with a fact, never altered a disagreeable word to suit the pleasure or convenience of any mortal being, least of all his own children, who sprung from his loins should be aware from childhood that life is difficult, facts uncompromising, and the passage to that fabled land where our hopes are extinguished, our frail barks founder in darkness, one that needs above all courage, truth, and the power to endure. Mr. Ramsay's fantasies take quite a satirical pounding. Those little eyes are always searching the horizon for some inhospitable sea or ice field in which the speaker of truth may die, ever so heroically alone. The Ramsays have an unpleasant fight about the next day's weather, after which Mr. Ramsay wordlessly apologizes for his rudeness and wordlessly again begs for sympathy for some soothing of his vanity and egotism. It is a solace that Mrs. Ramsay gladly gives. Reconciled with her husband, she sits at the window knitting like one of the Fates, and then she receives the impression I have described of fullness or sufficiency. How could any lord have made this world, she asked. With her mind, she had always seized the fact that there is no reason, order, justice, but suffering, death, the poor. There is no treachery too base for the world to commit. She knew that. No happiness lasted, she knew that. She knitted with firm composure, slightly pursing her lips, and without being aware of it, so stiffened and composed the lines of her face in a habit of sternness, that when her husband passed, though he was chuckling at the thought that Hume, the philosopher, grown enormously fat, had stuck in a bog, he could not help noting as he passed the sternness at the heart of her beauty. It saddened him, and her remoteness pained him, and he felt as he passed that he could not protect her. And when he reached the hedge, he was sad. He could do nothing to help her. He must stand by and watch her. Indeed, the infernal truth was he made things worse for her. He was irritable. He was touchy. He had lost his temper over the lighthouse. He looked into the hedge, into its intricacy, its darkness. Always Mrs. Ramsay felt one helped oneself out of solitude reluctantly by laying hold of some little odd or end, some sound, some sight. She listened, but it was all very still. Cricket was over. The children were in their baths. There was only the sound of the sea. She stopped knitting. She held the long reddish-brown stocking dangling in her hands a moment. She saw the light again, with some irony in her interrogation. For when one woke at all, one's relations changed. She looked at the steady light, the pitiless, the remorseless, which was so much her, yet so little her, which had her at its beck and call. But for all that, she thought, watching it with fascination, hypnotized, as if it were stroking with its silver fingers some sealed vessel in her brain whose bursting would flood her with delight. She had known happiness, exquisite happiness, intense happiness, and had silvered the rough waves a little more brightly. as daylight faded and the blue went out of the sea, and it rolled in waves of pure lemon which curved and swelled and broke upon the beach, and the ecstasy burst in her eyes, and waves of pure delight raced over the floor of her mind, and she felt, it is enough, it is enough. My resistance crumbled forever. In the end, it wasn't much of a struggle. Magnificence was not something any mere mortal should attempt, and Wolf had pulled it off. First the world of suffering and disorder, the darkness of the tangled hedge, Mr. Ramsay's sense, this time offered without satire, of isolateness, and his fear that his wife was alone and that he could not reach her. And then after the shift back to Mrs. Ramsay's consciousness, the attempt to hold on to some small tangible thing, a sound, a household ritual, and finally the light, the affirmation of life's sufficiency. And throughout the language gathering tension in its repetitions and short breaths, and finally easing and lengthening out at the end, right into the great crescendo. It is enough. Whatever else the passage meant, it was also a great moment for readers of Lit Hum. For the passage is both a fulfillment of the Western tradition and a challenge to it. And I felt a surge of emotion as I remembered the books that came before Virginia Woolf, the students struggling from within the great media bog to read and to understand. Mrs. Ramsay knitting at her window evokes Penelope from the Odyssey. Mr. Ramsay is an Odysseus who can't get past a certain point in his philosophical journeys. But more to the point, Mrs. Ramsay experiences with such heightened delight what might be called an anti-Faustian impulse. Faust, in Goethe's version of the legend, will lose his wager with Mephistopheles and get dragged off to hell if ever he should tell the passing moment, "Oh, stay, you are so beautiful." And so he strives for more life, more knowledge, more power and pleasure, and that, as we've seen, is the archetypal Western impulse, the restless ambition for more. And Mrs. Ramsay wants to say nothing but, "Oh, stay, you are so beautiful." Mrs. Ramsay makes things happen, creating children and marriages, causing dinner table conversation to merge and flow, harmonizing, unifying, ordering a whole range of experience. Mrs. Ramsay, who knits things together, wants to defeat her old antagonist, life, that is, time, and hold everything in place. But she can't do it. She can make only a momentary stay against confusion. And the book asks the question, is that enough? Mrs. Ramsay's solitary moments of consciousness ring out like great arias of protest and celebration. There was something so tremendous in this writing, supple, cultivated, yet expansive and reckless, that my distaste for it as a young man now puzzled me the way an early fear of riding would amaze someone galloping across a meadow. The chain of pleasure lengthened and grew stronger. I would stop and drift off as I read, just as I had at the beginning of the year, but I no longer grew exasperated with myself. I strayed, I wandered without shame, but not into fantasies of wealth or power or sex, and not into media images either. I wandered into realms I had forgotten until Wolf licensed remembering. As a small boy, I now remembered, I would often go by myself into some normally crowded and noisy place, a family dining room, a rec room at camp, when everyone was gone. I wanted to know, I think, what happened when the din of work and pleasure, the din of use, died away and nothing was going on at all. Sitting on the floor, I would stare at some odd bits of fluff rolled up into the corners or at the bottom of the chair legs where the dark stain was worn away. The floor was speckled with white paint, as if ants had laid down plates for dinner. The chairs faced each other in a sociable order, like the furniture on a stage set after the curtain has gone down. And growing more and more melancholy, I would try to hear something, a remnant, an echo. Without knowing why, children are often terribly sad. A trifle sets them off, and for a while they are inconsolable, their bafflement driving them further into grief. They feel almost a thrill of sadness, as if someone were sure to abandon them. What I did, wandering and sitting still in empty rooms, was, I think, a way of expressing childish grief. I wanted to know what absence felt like. Was absence just a variation on living, or a kind of death? When the room was empty, it was as if all the people no longer existed. I was trying to hear their sounds after they were dead. Or so I think now. In his last year, collapsing from a stroke, Henry James thought he heard a voice, not his own, saying, "So here it is at last, the distinguished thing." James' voicing of death is both hilarious and profoundly heroic. I had forgotten my empty room obsession for a long time, and as an adult I was incapable of thinking about the distinguished thing. When I tried to think of death, my mind hit a wall. I did not accept it, as the psychologists and TV talk show hosts would have us do. Yet this early preoccupation with vacated rooms came back to me when I read Wolfe's incomparable passages on the mortal life of the Ramsay's empty house. In Time Passes, the second section of To the Lighthouse, Wolfe constructs a kind of metaphysical horror movie. It is quite a scare show. Every bit as frightening as Homer's quivering spear in the warrior's heart. The Ramsays are away, off in London, and at first the abandoned house is innocence. Nothing penetrates the dusty silence but the falling cries of birds, the drone and hum of the fields, a dog's bark, a man's shout. Then the house begins to crack and fade. The war intrudes, and within the house there came later in the summer ominous sounds, like the measured blows of hammers dulled on felt, which with their repeated shocks still further loosened the shawl and cracked the teacup. Now and again some glass tinkled in the cupboard, as if a giant voice had shrieked so loud in its agony that tumblers stood inside a cupboard vibrated too. The atmosphere turned sinister, even apocalyptic. And one remembers that in the prologue to this section, when the Ramsays were still in the house, one of the guests, the poet Augustus Carmichael, lies in bed reading Virgil. He blows out his candle, and now thinking back on that moment, lit hum readers would recall that Virgil was Dante's guide through hell in the Inferno. This a clue? What happens in the empty house begins to seem an inferno without Virgil as guide. The candle is out. War rages outside the house, and echoes are heard inside. And no one is there but the baffled novelist to give the meaning. In the Old Testament, God had frightened Job with the wails he had made, in comparison to which man was nothing. But now Wolfe writes, night after night, summer and winter, the torment of storms, the arrow-like stillness of fine weather, held their court without interference. Listening, had there been anyone to listen, from the upper rooms of the empty house, only gigantic chaos, streaked with lightning, could have been heard tumbling and tossing, as the winds and waves disported themselves like the amorphous bulks of leviathans, whose brows are pierced by no light of reason, and mounted one on top of another, and lunged and plunged in the darkness for night and day, month and year, ran shapelessly together in idiot games, until it seemed as if the universe were battling and tumbling in brute confusion and wanton lust aimlessly by itself. So the creatures that God had said beholdeth all high things were now plunging the seas in meaningless violence, their brows pierced by no light of reason. The Ramsay's house, besieged by time and by God's indifference, seems to contain all of European civilization, cracking, rotting, falling into ruin. By this point, we begin to realize that the entire book is a recapitulation and an elegy, a remembrance of the life that died in the First World War, and that each of Wolfe's characters, passing everything through his mind, recapitulates the moral history of the West. In this novel, Taylor was saying, the romantic image has gone into symbol. The people transcend their normal social reality, and you're going to get a symbolic picture of marriage. Mr. Ramsey wants only one thing, complete admiration, the assurance that his books are going to live. Mrs. Ramsey gives over to him. It's a great marriage, but someone has to give. There was a stirring in the room. Sterngold did not like the idea that someone had to give in order to make a great marriage. I didn't like it either, nor did I believe it. But Taylor was beginning to wind up the class, winding up the year, and he jumped ahead. Look for the turning points, the symbolic turning points, he said, and you'll find the meaning. And together we found one of them, a moment at the end, when the Ramsey children, the teenage James, earlier thwarted by his father, and his sister Cam, are out there on the boat with Mr. Ramsey, at last heading toward the lighthouse, and the two of them, locked in anger at their father, are having a fierce, unspoken debate about whether to give him the sympathy he wants. Cam, who is considering forgiveness, looks at her brother and sees James the lawgiver with the tablets of eternal wisdom laid open on his knee. At that moment, James will not forgive, but he eventually gives way. We're moving from the Old Testament and justice to the new, which insists on mercy, said Taylor. Sterngold was incensed. Why should they give in to him, she said. She cocked her head and glared the way she always did when she was angry. A tough customer. Sterngold had stubbornly rejected the New Testament's notion of time. She had found Dante's revenges on his fellow Florentines unjust. Sterngold wanted justice. She was not about to give up the Old Testament, nor was she about to agree that women had to give in to men. Gender had come in the door, as it should. The man-woman issue and questions of feminist consciousness and practice were never distant from almost any discussion of Wolfe. Taylor dealt with such things in his way, and I saw the point of his method, and I admired it, but I knew there was a great deal more to say. For instance, there was an awkward truth that Taylor did not mention, and that freshmen were not likely to know. Many of the most prominent male literary critics of the century had ignored or dismissed Virginia Woolf. Her current canonical status, with which Taylor clearly agreed, is scarcely imaginable without the surge of feminist criticism in the last 30 years or so. The canon has creaked, cracked, and burst open. For Woolf was more worldly and hard-headed than her early male detractors, or the mentioners in passing ever implied. Into the lighthouse, a good part of the moral and literary history of the West was there as well, and if the struggles in consciousness between one character and another lack the brutal vitality of such moments in Homer and Shakespeare, Virginia Woolf, nevertheless, had her own kind of momentousness. What passed through the character's mind stretched, despite its connection to the domestic moment. No, because of that connection, to the eternal questions. What was reality? What was life for? How could man and woman live together? What did women see and feel that men had no notion of? In 1929, 2 years after publishing To the Lighthouse, Virginia Woolf brought out A Room of One's Own, an explicit feminist polemic, and Professor Shapiro's class, before ending the year with Conrad, had taken it on. It's a little book, but the whole issue of the canon and its relation to social injustice is here. Virginia Woolf had not gone to university. Her brothers did, of course. She was privately tutored, and she read enormously in the library of her father, Leslie Stephen, a considerable critic and philosopher. In 1928, the women's colleges at Cambridge Girton and Newnham, asked her to deliver some lectures on the subject of women in fiction. What she finally published as A Room of One's Own, an expanded and revised version of these talks, is a feminist polemic in the form of a comic novel, a novel on the subject of delivering lectures about women. At first, Wolfe seems to be lost, puttering about in genteel dither, as if searching haplessly for a missing glove. Oh dear, the subject is difficult. What shall she say? Women and literature, how tiresome. She cannot simply give a lecture. She could never come to a conclusion. She must approach the truth roundabout. She must approach with fiction. She makes up a character, Mary Beaton, who stands in for herself and who studies and muses, searching the British Museum like some blue stocking Diogenes for the truth about women and writing. It is all play, but with a hidden sting. The mock helplessness is a taunt, a way of provoking male impatience with female minds. Wolfe joshes the rigidities of academic discourse as well. The book is a superb example of anti-academic insolence, as much so today as in 1929. Wolfe can make no argument without first grounding it in fiction, and fiction depends on the materials of life, the actual lawns of Cambridge, which Mary traverses, she is ordered off them, and its libraries, which she tries to enter, she is barred, the streets of London and so on. Grounding everything in food and money and London coal chutes, Wolfe wanders about and touches, as if by chance, on the economic subjection of women, the male need for dominance, and the way gifted women have been confounded and defeated. In passing, finding her glove and putting it on, Wolfe offers an enchantingly tender yet stunningly rigorous critical history of women's imaginative writing in Britain. She lists the material requirements for a writer's life, some money and a room of one's own, and sets out the ideal qualities of a woman novelist. It is all there, the feminist case, at least for middle-class women, but stated lightly, easily, devastatingly. Perhaps too lightly for some readers. In Shapiro's class, the discussion came around to the issue of anger, which Wolfe, in a remarkable turn, described as a threat to literature. She thought it harmed literature's poise, distracting a writer from the fictional world she was creating. It was an opinion the women students, some of whom had attended Take Back the Night, found hard to accept. But then Susan, one of Shapiro's more earnest students, trying to reconcile anger and Wolfe's strictures against it, said, "In the past, women were not allowed to own their anger, to express it. And now, if you express that anger in life, you won't have to express it in literature." This was an interesting remark that Wolfe, I think, would have liked. Wolfe did not disapprove of anger in life. She was against it in literature when it became something obvious and didactic, as compared to her own very evident anger, which cultivated in silken irony, was viciously exact. Would the students understand that anger was necessary, but never enough? The women were alive, but the men were crabby and ploddingly rational. Anger, after all, took many different forms. Farid, a logical fellow from Abu Dhabi, claimed that he hadn't learned anything new, which struck me as highly unlikely. And the ascetic and fleshless Alex announced in his dry voice that a room of one's own was uneven and self-indulgent and full of tedious ideas that were misleading in relation to the book's own thesis. There was a shocked silence. The stinger had found its hide. Wolfe knew that there would always be a priggish Alex to read her books. Hearing him, she might have said that he needed a woman's mind to fertilize his categorical nature, to broaden and soften his harsh distinctions, his either-or temperament. A room of one's own is a work of art whose arguments are so thoroughly intertwined with metaphor, comedy, and anecdote that the political line of the argument is inseparable from the aesthetic performance embodying it. Charmed, many of us stopped seeing a political line at all. Deploring the too virile male novel, Wolfe calls for a mixing of male and female characteristics, the androgynous mind as exemplified by Shakespeare, as the necessary intellectual soil of fiction. She wants a roundedness and sympathy of observation that goes beyond sex partisanship. By the end of the lectures, one has a complete view of the subject. The reader says, "Here is a woman writing. What she is doing now is exactly what she is calling for." Well, how could this writer who grounds everything in money and food not be deeply offended in her soul by the theoretical contemporary academic discourse? What she set up as an ideal for women has been ruled out of existence by that discourse. Follow Wolfe's steps, for we are coming to the heart of the matter. The first step, just as in To the Lighthouse, Wolfe complains in A Room of One's Own that the male urge to conquer everything demands of women constant support and admiration, and constant self-suppression. The men, though imposing and perhaps necessary, are also blind and sterile, and they drive women mad with rage. Yet Wolfe's fictional creation, Mary Beaton, Wolfe herself, has been lucky. Mary Beaton has a legacy of £500 a year from her aunt. This frees her to do something extraordinary. "I need not hate any man. He cannot hurt me. I need not flatter any man. He has nothing to give me." So imperceptibly, I found myself adopting a new attitude towards the other half of the human race. It was absurd to blame any class or any sex as a whole. Great bodies of people are never responsible for what they do. They are driven by instincts which are not within their control. They too, the patriarchs, the professors, had endless difficulties, terrible drawbacks to contend with. Their education had been in some ways as faulty as my own. It had bred in them defects as great. True, they had money and power, but only at the cost of harboring in their breasts an eagle, a vulture, forever tearing the liver out and plucking at the lungs. The instinct for possession, the rage for acquisition which drives them to desire other people's fields and goods perpetually, to make frontiers and flags, battleships and poison gas, to offer up their own lives and their children's lives. Walk through the Admiralty Arch, or any other avenue given up to trophies and cannon, and reflect upon the kind of glory celebrated there. Or watch in the spring sunshine the stockbroker and the great barrister going indoors to make money and more money and more money, when it is a fact that £500 a year will keep one alive in the sunshine. These are unpleasant instincts to harbor, I reflect. They are bred of the conditions of life, of the lack of civilization, I thought, looking at the statue of the Duke of Cambridge, and in particular at the feathers in his cocked hat, with a fixity that they have scarcely ever received before. And as I realized these drawbacks, by degrees fear and bitterness modified themselves into pity and toleration. And then in a year or two, pity and toleration went, and the greatest release of all came, which is freedom to think of things in themselves. That building, for example, do I like it or not? Is that picture beautiful or not? Is that, in my opinion, a good book or a bad? Indeed, my aunt's legacy unveiled the sky to me and substituted for the large and imposing figure of a gentleman, which Milton recommended for my perpetual adoration, the view of the open sky. Now the second step. Look at that formulation near the end. The greatest release of all, which is freedom to think of things in themselves. That is to see things in their own terms, without anger or ideology, without fear of men or even reference to men. Particularly to see and judge works of art, which is what Virginia Woolf does through large stretches of this little book. But isn't the freedom to think of things in themselves exactly the freedom that has been called illusory and impossible by the academic left? Nothing, it seems, can be seen or thought of in itself. Every judgment, every perception, we've been told, is conditioned by one's identity. By race, for instance, or by gender, or by class. By the illusion of objectivity and the trap of subjectivity. And most of all, by the accumulated patterns of language, which must necessarily command much of one's thinking, and which represent in their seeming innocence long-held formations of power. All of which is very provocative, but must yield to the incomparable force of Virginia Woolf thinking of things in themselves. The name for such a desire and such a practice is disinterestedness, which means the condition of not having a personal stake, a pecuniary or ideological interest in the outcome of a given inquiry. Woolf believes it is not only possible but necessary. And in a room of one's own, she thinks of a great many books, especially books by women, in themselves. That is, she judges them very firmly, without thought of how the author's sufferings might excuse the faults of their writing. She thinks that the oppression of women produces the bad writing. The women are angry and lose their way. They make speeches when they should be attending to the fictional situation. So history exists, and oppression is effective. It disfigures people. These authors have strengths and talent, but they don't quite make it. Woolf writes with great tenderness of the bitter Lady Winchelsea and of the mad Duchess Margaret of Newcastle. Hare-brained and fantastical, who nevertheless had a great gift and was mocked and ignored until she shut herself up in her house, and of the familiar Charlotte Bronte, whose powerful novels Jane Eyre and Villette contain an acidity which is the result of oppression, a buried suffering smoldering beneath her passion, a rancor which contracts these books, splendid as they are, with a spasm of pain. None of these women had freedom to think of things in themselves. Free of men, Woolf will read, she will judge, she will set standards. Jane Austen, Emily Bronte, and George Eliot are great. The others, though wonderful and certainly worth reading, are limited, often by their anger. But there it is. In the midst of this demand for liberation, in the full current of this passionate brief on behalf of women, Woolf affirms not only the traditional canon, but the absolute necessity of unyielding literary judgment. I can think of no more stirring an expression of intellectual honesty. Woolf said women needed money, space, and freedom, what we now call empowerment. Scholars and critics in the university have performed their own version of empowering formerly neglected writers. Women, blacks, or colonial subjects, or people who worked in low literary forms. They have read them. They have pulled a great deal of work from libraries and dusty attics, including slave narratives, diaries, fiction, and poetry by subject peoples in Africa or the Caribbean. They have studied novels by 18th century Irish or American women, and such popular genres as westerns, gothic romances, and detective novels. But the next step, the act of breathtaking intellectual honesty that Virginia Woolf performed, weighing, judging, placing, saying how writers may have been hurt as well as strengthened by their oppression, the scholar critics have frequently ignored. On the contrary, as we've heard, they have often turned the tables on standards, denouncing the old narrative of culture, casting out judgment altogether as a rigged game. My belated discovery of Virginia Woolf was caused by feminist academics forcing open the canon, and I am grateful for that. The canon, thank God, is not impermeable or fixed forever. It opens now and then. And of course, hundreds of lesser writers are wonderful to read. But I have not lost my faith in the necessity of defining criteria of greatness. No matter how many people formerly without power may be hurt by such judgments, greatness in literature is like sunshine. We receive immense pleasure from it, we take strength from it. And the books in such arbitrary selections as Columbia's reading lists have been assembled not by the exercise of class interest, but by thousands of readers over centuries, making precisely such discriminations as Virginia Woolf makes in this little book, cannon-bashing critics by confusing their own career agendas with literary history, breed cynicism about judgment altogether, and may end in destroying literature. For if their most nihilistic assumptions take hold, nothing will remain for literature but its claim on this or that injustice, this or that piece of turf, this or that formation of power. To some degree, this has already happened. People would not read boring books without career incentives to do so. Pleasure never lies, though pleasure requires cultivation, and complex pleasures the greatest cultivation of all, education. Professor Marina Van Zylen, who licensed Pleasure in Literature for serious undergraduates, spoke fervently about Woolf in her final classes. She had dark skin and darkly beautiful eyes, and a voice that was both school teacherly and radiant. And when she spoke to the young men and women, she drew them into an intimacy with her. In the modern period, we can't think of life as an epic about which we can make clear judgments. If you're looking for objectivity, for history, you're not going to get it in Woolf. You're going to get something else. She pointed to a passage in the last section of the book where the remaining Ramses are making their way to the lighthouse and Lily, trying to paint, sits on the lawn watching them. And Lily thinks that Mrs. Ramsey could resolve things, bring people together. She can make moments that stayed in the mind, affecting one almost like a work of art. Like a work of art, she repeated, looking from her canvas to the drawing room steps and back again. She must rest for a moment. And resting, looking from one to the other vaguely, the old question which traversed the sky of the soul perpetually, the vast, the general question which was apt to particularize itself at such moments as these, when she released faculties that had been on the strain, stood over her, paused over her, darkened over her. What is the meaning of life? That was all. A simple question. One that tended to close in on one with years. The great revelation had never come. The great revelation perhaps never did come. Instead, there were little daily miracles, illuminations, matches struck unexpectedly in the dark. Here was one. This, that, and the other. Herself and Charles Tansley, whom Lily had argued with. And the breaking wave. Mrs. Ramsey bringing them together. Mrs. Ramsey saying, "Life, stand still here." Mrs. Ramsey making of the moment something permanent, as in another sphere Lily herself tried to make of the moment something permanent. This was of the nature of a revelation. In the midst of chaos there was shape. This eternal passing and flowing, she looked at the clouds going and the leaves shaking, was struck into stability. "Life, stand still here," Mrs. Ramsey said. "Mrs. Ramsey, Mrs. Ramsey," she repeated. She owed it all to her. "Mrs. Ramsey makes moments," said Van Zylen, drawing in the students more intimately. "And Mrs. Ramsey dies, and a part of you dies. But there's a resurrection of life through art. Like a dead grandparent, a part of you is lost forever, but it can be resurrected. It can be resurrected in art." So the question receives its answer. Mrs. Ramsey's little moments survive. It is enough. Like Woolf, I could not come to a conclusion, for the Western classics did not mean any one thing. There was no single line of significance, no eternal truths, at least not of the type that William Bennett and Lynn Cheney thought they perceived. The Western classics were at war with one another, and there was only the experience of reading and its many shocks and comforts, its many small truths. And I thought back over my experience, my long, crowded, sofa-hugging year of concentrating and listening and drifting. And when I had unreeled in my head the film of the year's adventure, I understood at last what had haunted me so much about Virginia Woolf's writing. It is this. The way she represents the workings of the mind parallels the workings of education. When you fail to hold any moment of supreme consciousness, the way I had failed to hold my childish exploration of death in empty rooms, or my freshman reading of the Iliad, the moment drifts below as a buried reference, a normative check, a nutrient in the soil. Later it rises, or something rises out of it. In Woolf's writing, it rises in long aria-like passages, in which the many moments of registered anger, warmth, attraction, and revulsion are revived and joined to one another by association and placed into the thick mental air where they engage other people's emotions in tumultuous mute dialogue. Virginia Woolf dramatizes the habit of registering, forgetting, sorting, and retrieving. She wrote about special moments and also about what remains, about sensibility, the mental, thick, textured readiness that makes a person great. And so with education. What we read as teenagers, we forget. The specific matter, detached from what concerns us in the present, falls like sediment. What remains is not so much the books themselves as a certain readiness, not formal knowledge, but an imprint of the effort we made earlier to read and to understand. Call it taste, temperament, judgment, whatever. Curiously enough, Vladimir Nabokov wrote, "One cannot read a book. One can only reread it." Nabokov's remark is true, as well as clever. As long as one never forgets, the first sedimentary reading makes the rereading possible. And that is why it doesn't matter so much that some of us in class didn't get Oedipus or the Aeneid or Dante, or that I didn't get Virginia Woolf when I was 20. What was important was that I had read her, and then, further advanced along the chain of pleasure, I rose up to read her again. By the end of my year in school, I knew that the culture ideologues, both left and right, are largely talking nonsense. Both groups simplify and caricature the Western tradition. They ignore its ornery and difficult books. They ignore its actual students, most of whom have been dispossessed. Whether white, black, Asian, or Latino, American students rarely arrive at college as habitual readers, which means that few of them have more than a nominal connection to the past. It is absurd to speak, as does the academic left, of classic Western texts dominating and silencing everyone but a ruling elite or white males. The vast majority of white students do not know the intellectual tradition that is allegedly theirs any better than black or brown ones do. They have not read its books, and when they do read them, they may respond well, but they will not respond in the way that the academic left supposes. For there is only one hegemonic discourse in the lives of American undergraduates, and that is the mass media. What can be achieved through culture is the greatest range of pleasure and soulfulness and reasoning power that any of us is capable of. The courses in the Western classics force us to ask all those questions about self and society we no longer address without embarrassment. The questions our media-trained habits of irony have tricked us out of asking. In order to ask those questions, students need to be enchanted before they are disenchanted. They need to love the text before they attack the subtext. They need to read before they disappear into the aridities of electronic information. They need a chance at making a self before they are told that it doesn't exist. They need a strong taste of Europe so they can become better Americans. Walt Whitman said it this way in Leaves of Grass. Dead poets, philosophers, priests, martyrs, artists, inventors, governments long since, language shapers on other shores, nations once powerful, now reduced, withdrawn, or desolate. I dare not proceed till I respectfully credit what you have left wafted hither. I've perused it. Own it is admirable, moving a while among it. Think nothing can ever be greater, nothing can ever deserve more than it deserves. Regarding it all intently a long while, then dismissing it, I stand in my place with my own day here. Here lands female and male. Here the airship and airship of the world. Here the flame of materials. Here spirituality, the translatress, the openly avowed, the ever-tending, the finale of visible forms. Satisfier, after due long waiting, now advancing. Yes, here comes my mistress, the soul.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.